At his keynote address to the Digital Book World Conference today, Jonathan Taplin, who is a professor at the University of Southern California and director of the Annenberg Innovation Lab, cautioned that people may be sleeping through the revolution, at least those in the publishing world. And he really gave a kind of a wake-up call for everyone in the audience, one that was not particularly heartwarming, but does have a sort of uplifting moral at the end of it. I want to welcome him to Beyond the Book right now. Jonathan Taplin, good to have you join us.
Nice to be here.
It was entitled Sleeping Through the Revolution, and I think it really was a wake-up call for a lot of people in the room. In fact, it was not a heartwarming talk at all. I thought we were going to have to end it all with a bonfire of tablets and smartphones right in the middle of the room there. Is that what you intended? Did you really try to get people to wake up to something which you see as really kind of potentially going to damage publishing and media business for good?
Well, I'm first off, I'm not a Luddite, so I don't believe that technology is going to end our businesses. But because I came out of the music business working for Bob Dylan and the band and George Harrison and the film business working for Martin Scorsese, I've seen these businesses decimated by the digital revolution. And the problem isn't the digital revolution itself, but it's rather that the digital revolution has created these gigantic monopolies, specifically Google, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, that become control points, and these platforms are basically taking most of the revenue. And what we've seen is an erosion of money moving from people who own content, who create content, to people who own these monopoly platforms, on the order of $50 billion a year. And that has not been good for artists, for the people who are making things. And that's what I'm trying to point to. And these monopolies, because they get more and more power, both politically and economically, they make it very hard for people to make a living.
Well, Jonathan, you spoke about a kind of a sea change in the development of the internet, and you took us back to the very early days, back to the late 60s, to Stuart Brand and others who really saw this in a kind of countercultural way of really offering people a decentralized way to communicate. And then you say that there was a moment in the late 1980s when people like Peter Thiel really kind of turned it on its head and adopted an entirely different philosophy, which gave rise to these very monopolists. Tell us about that.
Well, the whole concept of the internet was that it would decentralize power and harmonize people. And people like Vint Cerf and Tim Berners-Lee and Stuart Brand and the people who built the early internet really saw it as a boon for artists because everyone could have access to the audience through the internet. But what's happened since the late 80s when Peter Thiel and these libertarians got into power was they didn't believe in this decentralization of power. They actually believed that the only way to make money in the current age is to own a monopoly. And they're very clear about it. So Google has 87% market share in search and search advertising. Facebook has 75% market share in social search. Amazon has probably 65% of the ebook market, maybe even 70% of the ebook market. And so their ability to be this choke point, which then pushes down prices for the creator, is really a problem for artists everywhere.
There's an argument that they would make, I think, which is that this is sort of a natural evolution in the internet, in the online world, and that competition is a kind of is for losers, as I think Peter Thiel wrote for a Wall Street Journal op-ed. Why do they see it that way? Why is competition the enemy for them?
Well, one could argue that there's a certain tendency towards what we call natural monopolies. In other words, if all your friends are on Facebook, you're going to want to be on Facebook too. You don't want to be on a social network that nobody else is on. If everyone is using Google, Google gets better because every user improves the search algorithms. So the question is not whether these are natural monopolies or not. It's just, are they unregulated natural monopolies? In other words, I'm old enough to have been alive when the Bell telephone system was the total monopoly of all phone calls in the United States. But it was a regulated monopoly which had to put a certain amount of its profits into research and development, and then it had to turn all the profits of that is what came out of the Bell Labs, over to the public for free to build on. And out of that came all sorts of new companies, Intel, Fairchild Semiconductor, Texas Instruments. But that's not what we have now. We have basically unregulated monopolies. And that is never good. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt was really clear that monopolies are not great. Now, what happened is that the Justice Department came to this notion around 1980 with a guy named Robert Bork, was that the only thing that mattered was consumer prices. So by that theory, if Walmart was the only merchandiser in the whole United States, but they kept lowering prices, then it would not be a monopoly. Or if Amazon was the only bookseller, but it kept lowering prices, it would not be a monopoly. But really what the monopoly statutes were put forth in the first place was to protect the small business person from the giant. And that has just gone out of favor right now, and that needs to be brought back.
And to your point that the view of the Justice Department is that antitrust is a matter of price, and if as long as the price goes down and the consumer is able to get whatever the product is at a lower price than in the past, this is a good thing. And you sort of alluded to something which your following speaker, Jessica Sanger, from the German Booksellers Association, made a point about, which is that antitrust law is not only about pricing, but it's about innovation. Can you speak to that? Do you see it that way?
Right. Well, what happens is if you get locked into these two or three platforms, then if they take all the rents, which is what the economists call it, they collect monopoly rents, then the possibility for other people to create businesses becomes almost impossible. Yesterday, a company called Meerkat, which was the innovator in live streaming video, announced it was going out of business because it couldn't compete against Facebook, because Facebook just decided it was going to go into the live streaming business, and it had all the people. So the ability of these big players to force the other small players either to sell to them or go out of business is what's the reality of the current situation.
Well, finally, Jonathan Taplin, it is 2016. It's an election year, and you spoke about some of the dangers of this situation. It goes beyond publishing to something you called the culture of the Colosseum. Is the world where the platform is king contributing to some of the things we're seeing in our campaigning this year?
I would say so. I mean, if you just look at the way Donald Trump uses Twitter to abuse his foes is pretty amazing. And it's not just him. He has 6 million followers on Twitter. So, you know, this Republican strategist about 3 weeks ago made a comment that Trump was afraid to debate in Iowa when he bowed out of the Megyn Kelly. So he posts something on Twitter that she's an idiot. And then his 6 million followers essentially jump on her like cyber brown shirts and made her life miserable. She had hate mail. She had threats. And she was basically pushed off of Twitter completely by these people who wouldn't let up. Even though Trump had moved on to abuse somebody else, the cyber brown shirts were right behind him and just piling on. And this is a phenomena of the current age. I don't think it's healthy. And obviously the anonymity that is afforded to people on Twitter, so they never are called to account for what they do, is what's so frightening about the whole thing.
Well, in the revolution, it often starts with the question, what is to be done? So, Jonathan, what's to be done?
So I think there are two things to be done. First off, I am heartened by the notion that we live in what Jeremy Rifkin calls a zero marginal cost society. That is, the cost to move bits, like the bits on this recording, from one place to another, are almost nothing. And so the costs of distribution are very, very low, which means to me that the cost of the platform itself should be very low, and most of the money should be flowing to the artists, unlike a situation where, say, Amazon or Apple take 30 to 40% of the rent for just providing the platform, it should be closer to 10%. So my thesis is that starts from two things. One, rigid antitrust enforcement. These companies should not be able to buy any new companies, and they should have to surrender some of their intellectual property to the commons. And the second part is potentially the possibility of artist cooperatives. I've cited the example of Magnum, which works so well in the photography business as the great artist co-op. But there are many other examples. Sunkist Oranges is part of a cooperative where all the growers own the platform, the distribution platform. And that means that the people who are actually making the product are getting more of the money, and the middlemen are getting less. And that's the way it should be in the digital age.
Well, Jonathan Taplin, keynote speaker today at the Digital Book World 2016 conference. He is a professor at the University of Southern California, director of the Annenberg Innovation Lab, and author of the forthcoming book next year, spring 2017, from Little Brown, called Sleeping Through the Revolution. Thank you so much for joining us on Beyond the Book.
My pleasure, Chris.